Public employee pensions and their impact on state and municipal budgets has become a contentious issue. Phoenix voters will have the chance later this year to dramatically change the system. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with a supporter and an opponent of the ballot initiative and find out whether the proposal is fair or not. Plus, if you like driving to downtown Phoenix for dinner or a show, or if you have to go there on business, be prepared to pay a lot more to park at a city meter. I'll talk with Arizona Republic reporter Eugene Scott about how high the rates could go. We'll also find out what other big cities are doing. Also, this week's settlement of a lawsuit over the use of player images is just another indication that the current world of college athletics could soon be upended. A sports law attorney will update us on other litigation and the increasing cost of doing business. And why are so many young immigrants crossing the border, and what conditions are they being kept in? Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, parking meter rates in downtown Phoenix are on the verge of a major increase. I'll talk with Arizona Republic reporter Eugene Scott about what may be in store, and a Harvard research fellow will explain what other big cities have done and what effect there has been. Plus, a ballot initiative will give Phoenix voters a chance to dramatically change the city's pension system. We'll hear from an opponent. Also, a $20 million settlement with the NCAA could indicate that we're moving in the direction of financial compensation for student athletes. Sports law attorney Timothy Liam Epstein will offer his perspective. We start today's program with an update on the situation affecting thousands of undocumented children who cross the U.S.-Mexico border. Several advocacy organizations filed a complaint with the federal government today, claiming unaccompanied immigrant children are regularly mistreated while in Customs and Border Protection custody. The complaint was filed on behalf of 116 children who were between the ages of 5 and 17. They allegedly suffered physical and sexual abuse, denial of food, water, and medical treatment, and were held by CBP far longer than legally allowed. Joseph Anderson with Americans for Immigrant Justice says he thinks these conditions have existed for years.
We believe thousands of children have been subject to these conditions, and that while the surge in the number of unaccompanied minors crossing the border exacerbates this problem, it's a pre-existing problem and one that we feel the Department of Homeland Security has probably been aware of for some time.
DHS, which oversees Customs and Border Protection, received the complaint earlier today and has not yet responded to a request for comment. For more details, we're joined now by Los Angeles Times reporter Cindy Carcamo. Cindy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Give us a description, if you can, of what the conditions the children are facing, the children that are there now in the Nogales area who've been shipped over from Texas for the most part.
Yes, well, you know, first of all, Department of Homeland Security is not letting any media inside the actual Nogales facility. So a lot of the reports that I'm getting are from actually the Guatemalan consul or organizations, community organizations that have had access, and also state legislators who have actually gone in and had access to that shelter there. But what we're hearing is that really they're stretched to their limits. This is something that Department of Homeland Security had, supposedly prepared for. They said that they were that they expected this influx of Central Americans, but not at this rate. So it really has taken them aback. And because of that, you know, they've had to transfer people from the Texas area, where a lot of these Central Americans are coming from, and taking them to the Nogales shelter and other shelters around as well. And it seems like the area where these children, the unaccompanied minors, are being kept used to be a warehouse facility that CBP bought back in the day, and they've transformed it to kind of like this triage center where they have portable toilets, temporary showers, recreational, you know, they're giving people food, unaccompanied minors food, and other sorts of things in regard to kind of keep them there as comfortable as they can. But the situation is evolving, and more children are being transported every day. So as to whether this will cease, a lot of people aren't optimistic about that. They think that this is going to continue for the foreseeable future.
Cindy, two-part question. Why is it that so many children seem to be coming across, and at the same time, there's a separate influx of parents with children as well? We're not hearing quite as much about the parents, but can you talk about those together? Why are we seeing so many more coming through?
Yes, well, you're seeing two different sorts of sets of people coming through. You know, unaccompanied children, from what I'm hearing from the unaccompanied children, is that Things in Central America are really, really violent right now. And there's always been this crushing poverty. But the escalation in violence is really what's prompting unaccompanied children to cross the border and basically give themselves up to immigration officials. Now, at the same time, you also have parents with children who are coming over right now. And same thing, you know, poverty, but also escalating violence in Central America, particularly Honduras. But the parents with children that I have spoken with have told me that they're coming now because they're hearing about this new opportunity. There are rumors circulating throughout Central America that if the parent comes with at least one child and gives themselves up to an immigration official, that they will be released. But that's only half the story. Technically, they are, but really there aren't, because at the end of the day, they have to report to immigration officials within 15 days, and as to whether, you know, what's going to happen to them in regards to the parents with children, it's really left up to that immigration official and whether they're going to have their day in court or if they're going to be removed immediately. So there definitely are rumors in Latin America right now, in Central America, and I'm also hearing it in country from my sources in Guatemala in particular, that these rumors are circulating, and because of that, people are coming now.
Cindy, this has been called by many, some politicians, so I guess we have to take that with a grain of salt, and yet based on what you're describing and what you've heard, this really does seem like it's on the verge of a humanitarian crisis. So how can something like this, are you hearing anything about how something like this can be massaged to make sure that these kids who may have come through no choice of their own and they're in this position, and it just seems like an absurd, scary situation at the same time. What are people telling you about? Are there any sort of short-term, not even fixes, but short-term ways to massage the situation?
Yes, it is. I mean, it really is a humanitarian crisis, just looking at it. But, you know, this sort of thing has been happening for a while. You know, unaccompanied children coming over to the United States, it's just that there's been this surge lately. So really that's what's taken officials aback. And I think that they're doing what they can to triage, and that's why they're moving people from Texas to different parts of the country to keep these children, safe and safe as they can be, I guess. So really, you know, talking with immigration officials, talking with Department of Homeland Security officials, they had a press conference the other day that was all on background, but still, I mean, they said that what they're doing is trying, I mean, right now it's just really short term. They're just trying to deal with the influx. Long term thinking, I don't think they're even at that point yet. Because, you know, after these children are kept in the shelter, they're only supposed to be kept there for about 72 hours. After that, they're, you know, I'm talking about the Nogales facility in particular. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they're supposed to be transferred to different areas, either in San Antonio or Ventura County or Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where it's a more permanent facility. And they can be kept there for, numerous amounts of weeks. I think it's something like the average day is like 150 or something like that days. And while they are looking for the parents or some kind of next of kin for the child so they can place the child with that person, while this vetting is happening, they're being kept in this facility. But, you know, during this whole time, I think that there's a real misconception out there that these kids are going to be scot-free into the country. That's not the case at all. These kids the whole time are under removal proceedings, and they're going to have to, you know, end up going to immigration court. And children are not I've heard of stories where, a five-year-old child is representing themselves in immigration court, because the way immigration court works is that people are not entitled to an attorney. So if they don't have good representation, I mean, it's really at the discretion of the immigration judge as to whether that person will be deported or will be removed. If that person might have a good case, it might not ever come out to light because they don't have a good representation, or they don't have representation at all.
Cindy, this is a strange question to end on, but I'm curious as to whether, I know we don't really know details, but there has been some action taken in Congress. The Obama administration had asked for $2 billion, and I know we don't know details about how that would be spent, but that has been in the works for a little bit of time. Can you interpret that for us? Did they have some better idea that there was going to be some sort of influx? Because $2 billion sounds like a lot of money.
Yes, and I think that the $2 billion is more than they expected to spend, I believe, because I think they did have, and we had, there was this telebriefing on Monday with, senior administration officials, and what they said was that they expected there to be an increase of Central Americans coming through this year, but they were not prepared for the amount, for the surge, or for the, you know, how many people are coming in right now. So definitely they were taken by surprise. They were trying to prepare, but I don't think they prepared for the amount of people that they're actually receiving now.
Los Angeles Times reporter Cindy Carcamo joined us from Southern Arizona. Cindy, thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
We started today's program with word on a legal complaint filed by a group of organizations related to how unaccompanied immigrant children have been treated. Earlier, I spoke with James Lyle, staff attorney for the ACLU, who brought details.
Administrative complaint that ACLU and four other organizations filed with DHS oversight agencies on behalf of 116 unaccompanied children who were abused by Border Patrol and Customs and Border Protection officials in their custody. The abuses described in this complaint, which we submitted this morning to DHS oversight, are truly horrific. The stories involve pregnant mothers and infants being denied medical care, food, and water, children who have been provided with rotten food or the only available water to drink came out of toilet tanks, children alleging sexual assault, beatings, many who were shackled or subject to strip searches, forced into stress positions. The stories go on, and unfortunately, they are not new. These documented abuses have been reported to oversight agencies in the past, have been reported by academics and NGOs going back years, and the government still has not taken any action to address them, and they continue.
And are you willing to say why you think there hasn't been action taken by the Department of Homeland Security or any other organization to put a stop to it?
Well, unfortunately, CBP, Department of Homeland Security, and especially the Border Patrol are extremely resistant to reform and have been in a variety of ways. This is just the latest example of the need for extensive fundamental agency reform. The lack of oversight and accountability, the lack of transparency, the lack of any clear complaint process, the fact that so many of these abuses are massively underreported for all of those reasons, based on all those factors. All of this relates to unaccompanied children and their abuse by CBP officials, but it also relates to the broader problems within the agency that have not been addressed. As the agency has doubled in size twice over the last two decades, no one has put in any of the kinds of best practices or checks or oversight measures that one would expect of even a much smaller law enforcement agency, much less the largest federal law enforcement agency in the country.
James, finally, what will take us past the complaint level to an official suit? What's the next step?
Well, so one of the organizations involved in the complaint, Americans for Immigrant Justice, just filed last week a lawsuit on behalf of someone who was detained in a Yalera, freezing cold detention cell. Certainly nothing in this complaint precludes further litigation. I think many of these children have viable claims for relief. But really, we wanted to bring these abuses to the attention of DHS and oversight agencies so that they can take action against agents who are abusing children as quickly as possible. This is an urgent crisis that needs to be addressed, but it's also, again, part and parcel of much broader problems within the agency, an agency that where reforms are long overdue.
James Lyle, staff attorney for the ACLU. James, thanks for squeezing us in.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about pension reform in the city of Phoenix. Also, why are parking meter rates downtown about to go up a lot? And then a little bit later on, we'll find out what the loss of Eric Cantor last night in his congressional primary means for the future of immigration reform. That's still to come on Here and Now. Stay tuned. It's 1120 at KJZZ. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein. State and municipal pension plans have been receiving a lot of attention across the country. Some tie especially generous plans to the need to make deeper budget cuts. There's broad agreement that some sort of reform is needed, but what should that entail? Phoenix residents will have the opportunity to vote on the Phoenix Pension Reform Act. Supporters say it'll put the city's finances on more solid ground, in part by overhauling the current system and replacing it with a 401k-style retirement system for new city employees. Opposition to the plan is led by former City Councilman Tom Simplot of Phoenix Citizens for Pension Responsibility, and he joins me in studio. Tom, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What got you involved in this? Obviously, you were heavily involved as a councilman, but why are you so opposed to the Reform Act that's been put out there?
Well, my last 2 years on council, 2 to 3 years on council, I spent considerable time actually working with the community, working with my colleagues, working with our employees to actually reform the pension plan that we have at the City of Phoenix. And that's exactly what we did. So to see this initiative go to the ballot in the fall, claiming to actually be pension reform, well, they're a little late to the party. We already reformed the pension plan. Their initiative is truly about eliminating the city pension program.
Okay, now the 401k style plan we're hearing about is supposed to apply just to new city employees. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that is we have to figure out how to pay for all of those that are in the current plan to start with. So when you look at their plan, when you read the initiative, what they talk about is there's generally no cost. They're going to save money over time. What they don't say is that in order to pay for this plan, it will be about $400 million cost increase to Phoenix taxpayers. And when we look at the reforms we already did, and let's go back to what the voters approved just a year ago, the voters approved almost $600 million in pension reforms just a year ago. Over the next 25 years, we'll see those. A year ago, the city council was able to enact additional pension reforms, saving over $200 million over the next 25 years. And just recently, the city council approved employee union contracts, saving another $60 million over the next 24 years. Pension reform has happened. It's past tense.
It's happened, Tom, but there would be some critics who would say, why do we have to wait 25 years for this to happen when the city is in a position like it is? And obviously many other huge cities across the country, there have even been some who've used the name Detroit, and they've worried about whether Phoenix could ever be in that position. So why is it that it has to be in the past? Aren't there incremental changes that could still be made?
These are the incremental changes. That's exactly what we're making. And Steve, it's interesting you mentioned Detroit. Detroit actually adopted a 401k plan and found out that it cost even more. And that's what we're trying to get across to voters and educate the voters and residents about now. This is not about saving money. This is about a different philosophy about how to take care of our employees. That's really what it boils down to.
So you don't have an alternative plan. You're saying that based on what has been done, that's fine. This is an opposition to what Phoenix voters are going to vote on.
Right. We've already instituted reform time and time again. Again, almost $900 million worth of savings to the taxpayers over the next 25 years. Reform has happened. It's occurred. We listened. We knew something needed to be done. And the elected officials and the voters responded.
Well, so what do you think is going on here then?
What's happening as we see it across the country is I think the pendulum is swinging, and there are folks with a certain political philosophy that believe that pensions should simply go away. Now, You want to debate that issue? Debate that issue. But this initiative goes much, much farther. As a matter of fact, to me, it's a bait and switch. They talk about reforming pensions, but that's really not the net result of this initiative. It's eliminating one pension plan and instituting another, and at a cost of $400 million to the taxpayers to do so.
Tom, is this action being taken by those who are supporters of the Reform Act in the same sense people complain about the state legislature sometimes, sort of deciding they're not really sure they can do something about it, we'll let voters decide? Although what you're saying is the city council actually acted and the people didn't really like, those who were supporters of this Reform Act didn't like what the council did.
Absolutely. And Steve, you make another good point is who exactly are these people? I've got to tell you, we don't know who's pushing this initiative. We don't know where the money's coming from. We don't know if it's in-state or out-of-state. And at the end of the day, we also know that there's going to be litigation costs involved in defending this initiative should it pass. And so voters need to know that taxes or services will go down. Taxes will go up or services will go down if this passes. Number two, the benefits to the employees will decrease. And number three, litigation costs. We will be in court for years on this if it passes.
Tom, you're not an economist, but the economy works in cycles. And obviously, we had one of the worst cycles ever a few years ago. What happens when the economy inevitably takes at least a little bit of a nosedive? So we're in a situation where maybe more pension reform could be needed at that point? Or are you saying that that's, I mean, if we look into the future, basically what we've done is okay? Because even when you said reform is in the past, we can't always say that, can we? Because situations change.
Absolutely, Steve. And you're right. It took 35 years to get to the point where we needed pension reform. There were a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And if you want to look at the onion, we keep peeling back the onion and finding things we can address. This initiative doesn't do that. This initiative tries to change the plan. Throwing the baby out with the bathwater, not needed. This will be an evolution. This will be a continual process. And it's up to our elected leaders and our public to be vigilant, to ensure that we do address this in incremental fashion and we don't allow the pendulum to swing so far out of whack again.
There have been national analysts, some who've given Phoenix credit for being ahead of the curve on some things. Was Phoenix behind the curve on this one, or did the economy catch folks by surprise?
Well, again, I think because it happened incrementally over 35 years with so many different elected officials, so many different city executives along the way, little by little, things were added to the benefit packages. So, for example, folks like to throw out all of the folks who they think abused the pension process. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a legitimate claim. However, that was all in the past. Every one of those folks they like to roll back out to the press is all past tense. Were we ahead of the game? I think we were in the game. I think we were vigilant along with the rest of the country at saying, we need to look at this and now is the time to do so. And we did.
Tom, let's broaden out a little bit to macro. As Phoenix has taken this step, we look ahead to savings over the next 25 years. I also mentioned in more general sense that pension reform has been a concern across the country. Is this a case, do you believe, that based on what Phoenix has done, that Phoenix can be sort of a pioneer for other areas around the country? Or is this going to be a case where at some point we decide, boy, we could have done that a little bit better and had even more savings?
Twofold, Stephen. Number one, yes, I think people will look at, I think industries will look at, and other governments will look at Phoenix and say, yes, they did the right thing at the right time. Now, the second part of that, though, is do we owe it to the taxpayers and our city government and ourselves to continuously look at this? And that's what we need to safeguard, is to ensure that we continuously do that. And I believe we will, because people are watching now. People are waiting to see if the pendulum will swing again. Right now, we have reforms in place, we're saving the taxpayers money, and we're still being fair to our employees, which is very important.
Tom, again, taking advantage of your political experience as a former councilman, is this a case where Phoenix is going to be at a disadvantage in getting new city employees, for example, either based on the current system or if the Reform Act passes and the 401k plan comes into effect?
Yes. Short answer is yes. For example, one of the reforms that we passed over the past 2 years was to actually impose a longer time period in order to retire if you're a second-tier employee at the City of Phoenix. It takes longer to retire and collect benefits now in the City of Phoenix than it does in any other city in Arizona or the state government. So we're ahead of the curve on that. And I think we're going to continue to do that. Now, if this initiative were to pass, would we suddenly find ourselves at a disadvantage when trying to compete for the best and brightest talent out there? Without a doubt.
Tom, remind voters when they'll get a chance to take a hack at this, one way or the other.
This November. We don't even have a prop number yet, but it's going to be on the ballot in November.
Okay, so voter turnout, one would expect in a congressional year, going to be a little bit higher. How might that affect this?
It's hard to say. That's why it's so important we educate the voters so they know what's in the initiative. And please, if you're listening to this, read the initiative. Decide for yourselves. But at the end of the day, I think you're going to agree. It increases costs, less benefits for the employees, and it's a reason to vote no.
Former Phoenix City Councilman Tom Simplot, who's leading Phoenix Citizens for Pension Responsibility. Tom, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll be talking about Phoenix parking rates downtown. Might be taking a precipitous climb. Plus, we'll talk about the possibility of compensating college athletes. All of that's still to come.
KJZZ is supported by Stimson Leonard Street. With more than 520 attorneys providing transactional and litigation legal services from 14 offices across the country, online at StimsonLeonard.com.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Stay with us at noon for NPR's Here and Now, and at 1 we'll have BBC NewsHour. Checking temperatures around the state right now, it's 72 degrees in Flagstaff, 81 in Prescott, 97 in Casa Grande, it's 99 degrees in Tucson, and 96 in Yuma. In Valley traffic, watch out for a crash in the median on the State Route 51 southbound at Bell Road. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Dr. and Mrs. William Wachter, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. It's 97 degrees in Phoenix at 1130.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Parking in downtown Phoenix can be pretty inconvenient as you try to find a space close to where your business appointment or lunch meeting may be, but usually a meter is available, and up until now at least, it's reasonably priced. The Phoenix City Council might vote to change that this month, so get your credit card or a lot of quarters ready. To give us more details is Arizona Republic reporter Eugene Scott. Eugene, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So what might the parking rates change to? Can you give us the variables?
Yes. Well, the maximum they would be $4 an hour, and that is during peak hours. So that means during a Suns game or during a Beyonce concert. And that's in a very isolated part of the city, the downtown. It would be from about First Avenue to 7th Street and from Jefferson Street to Lincoln Street. And so this is still it's yet to be approved by the city council. It's just been approved by the downtown subcommittee.
So tell us a little bit more about what meter hours could be changing. I understand that maybe weekend hours will be going more into effect.
Sure. Right now, you can park as long as you want in downtown Phoenix anywhere on the weekends and on holidays for no cost. And during the weeks, it's 8 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
But what it will change to if the city council approves is 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., weekends and holidays included.
Coming back to what you said about prime hours, and obviously a Suns game or a Beyonce concert is more fun than going downtown to work or a business appointment, but is prime time also considered this area of business hours, or is there the feeling that could be a problem, so let's not make those prime rate hours either?
Sure. Business day hours will not be considered prime time. There will be variable rates. That's what the whole change really is, varying rates depending on what is happening. But what's likely is that it won't remain what it is now, which is $1.50.
How much money is the city hoping will be brought in by the different rates?
As much as $2 million additional dollars a year.
Okay. And, you know, in the big picture, that doesn't sound like that much.
Well, for a city that just faced a $38 million budget cut or budget deficit, every million matters.
Okay. Do you know how much the city is making from the parking meters now?
Right now, the monthly average revenues are about $140,000 a month.
Okay. What have opponents been saying? I'm sure there are some people who don't want these rates to go up.
Sure. Well, I mean, quite frankly, there are some people that will not come to downtown Phoenix unless parking is free or it's $1.50 max. There are people who certainly do not like the change. But there are people who are definitely supporters of it. But, yeah, there are definitely people who are upset.
And are they upset about the fact that, as you said, they expect it to be almost what we used to say about the colleges in Arizona, as nearly free as possible?
Sure. Well, I mean, people struggle with change, and people don't always understand the need behind why this increase needs to happen. So the city seems to be trying to communicate why something like this has to happen. Phoenix is one of the few cities in the country that has free parking beyond 5 p.m. and charges as cheaply as it does. I mean, their city is significantly smaller than ours that charge way more for parking.
Have you heard any arguments like that, this idea that, you know, we've had it pretty good for a while, so in order to make a little extra money, this makes sense?
Well, yeah, that's the city staff's position. Phoenix, comparatively, for major cities, has long been affordable. I mean, you mentioned the ASU as cheap as possible tuition situation. That's not to dismiss the fact that increases are happening and that things are getting more expensive. But, I mean, to park in Milwaukee, which is a significantly smaller city, they're charging more than their meters run beyond midnight.
Wow. Did Phoenix learn from other cities' experiences?
Oh, yeah. They did they looked at a study that San Francisco did to see which other cities charge beyond past 5 p.m. and how much some cities charge during peak hours. As you can imagine, places like L.A. and New York charge $5 during peak hours.
Wow. Eugene, finally, give us the next step. So the council is going to vote on it. How soon, and how soon would then the changes be implemented?
They will vote on it on June 18th, so next week. They do not yet know when this change will happen, but they will certainly notify residents via website and other informationals as soon as possible.
And without knowing exactly, do you have a feel that it seems like the majority of the council will probably vote for this?
I do not know. The interesting thing with the downtown subcommittee is there's only one council member on the downtown subcommittee from downtown Phoenix. And so, and that's Councilwoman Kate Gallego. I'm very interested in hearing what Councilman Michael Nowakowski is going to say, because while he does not represent that part of the downtown, he definitely still represents it. And I'm really interested, quite frankly, in what fiscal conservatives like Jim Waring and Sal DeCicco are going to say as well.
Well, we'll wait and see. Arizona Republic reporter Eugene Scott. You can follow him on Twitter at @Eugene_Scott. Eugene, thanks.
Thank you.
Phoenix, as Eugene mentioned, is far from the first city to try new technology to deal with downtown parking congestion. Charlie Chippio, research fellow at the Ash Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, joins me now. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So you've written a little bit about this. I know you've studied it. The Los Angeles and San Francisco have taken some steps to make parking, it seems like more common sense, with the supply and demand concept. How does it seem to be working for them?
Well, you know, in both places, it seems to be working pretty well. I think the one thing that you see, the one thing that both have in common is that overall, the parking rate, what it costs, has either stayed the same or gone down, but the revenue is up slightly. And it seems to me that that's kind of a win-win because essentially, you know, the city is getting more revenue without consumers having to pay more, just based on better utilization.
Did they take the action for the same reason Phoenix is, to try to bring in a little extra money?
Well, you know, I always assume that bringing in a little extra money is never, you know, far from the mind of the city governments that do this kind of thing. But I think that was part of it. I think the other part of it, was it was really also about bringing in money, but in a more indirect way, which is making sometimes congested areas of downtown a little bit more welcoming to people that might want to come and, you know, go to a movie, go to a play, go to dinner, that kind of stuff, by making it a little easier for them to find a place to park.
When we talked to Eugene Scott just a minute ago of the Arizona Republic, he talked about the new meters in the sense that we'll have the variable parking times and it'll change. Can you talk about the high-tech aspect of some of these meters and how that's been a benefit as well?
Yeah, I mean, essentially the way you know it's worked, Steve, is that they, you know, you've essentially got what's the word I'm looking for? The things where that they detect. I'm blanking on the word. I'm sorry. The things that detect when cars come and go, and so they can essentially, you know, based on that, based on the sensors, they can tell what the demand is, and you know. From the demand, you know, they can then adjust the rate for the parking. When it comes to the sensors and all that kind of stuff and how they work, I would plead guilty to having about the same sense of technology that most riders do, which okay. is next to none. But the but the idea is that, you know, in San Francisco, for example, every week they change the rates, or, you know, the rates don't always change, but the rates are reviewed every week based on usage. In Los Angeles, I believe it's once a month. But the idea is that you'll always, thanks to the technology, get utilization. I think one thing that people need to understand is this is not something that is like, it's like in real time. It's not like the parking rate changes every 15 minutes or anything.
Okay,
but it's changed quite often.
Well, it's good to hear that they actually check it on a weekly or monthly basis, that it's not just, okay, we made this change and now we'll see what happens.
Right. You know, and the other good thing is the apps, you know, that you can get these apps where you can actually sort of drive into town and you can know exactly where you're going to be able to find some parking spaces. I mean, you know, I live in Boston, and I mean, I got to tell you, that's a revolutionary thought here. And so Phoenix is certainly population-wise is a lot bigger than Boston. So I got to think that it's that would certainly make it a little bit easier for people to go into town there as well.
And Charlie, what have you heard about environmental impact? Because you mentioned this idea of an area being more welcoming to folks who want to go downtown, either for a show or dinner or whatnot. Also, this idea that if spaces are more readily available based on the timing of things, that people won't be idling or driving around the block quite as much.
That's right. And, you know, I think as most of your listeners probably know, you know, that's the point, that's the time when you have the worst environmental impact, when a car is either, you know, idling or moving very slowly. And there's going to be a whole lot less of that, so you are definitely going to have a positive environmental impact as well. You know, to me, it's a lot like the sort of automated tolling ideas. It, you know, you get a lot of the same benefits, in my view.
Charlie, does the system seem fair? And I wonder about this because when rates, variable or not, if they go up at some point, is there a fear by anyone in a government or elsewhere that it's a have and have not situation? If the rates are too high, folks who may have lower paying jobs won't be able to use the meters anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that could conceivably happen, but I don't think it has been the experience up until now because, you know, say if your goal is to calibrate it such that there's, you know, one free space on, you know, on every block all the time, I mean, I would imagine that, you know, maybe on some blocks in Manhattan or something, you might have extremely high rates, but, you know, it really has not played out that way. Plus, invariably, the other thing that's happened from the cities that have tried this is that what you've gotten is a situation where just a couple of blocks away, you know, from where whatever a main street, you know, in Boston here, it might be near Fenway Park, you know, when there's a baseball game. You know, if you go just a couple of blocks away, invariably the rates there are going down. You know, so I think that I think that while that is something you definitely need to be aware of, that has not been the experience up until now where it's been tried.
So if you can walk a little bit farther, you may not have to pay the higher rate, though.
That's right. So that's another health benefit, right? You walk two or three blocks you might not otherwise have walked.
And Charlie, finally, are there any challenges that either people didn't think about before they started variable pricing or that things have popped up that you've noticed, you've read about?
Not that I've read about, but I'll tell you, I think that they will certainly come. And the reason I think that we haven't had a lot of unexpected challenges up until now is that the places like Los Angeles and San Francisco that I looked at the closest, you know, these are still pilot programs in a relatively small, limited geographic area. I think undoubtedly when you try to scale this up to a bigger area, you know, I mean, Phoenix is a perfect example because certainly, especially to somebody like me from Boston, Phoenix is a physically, you know, huge city. But I'm sure in that case, there'll be some unexpected challenges, but I haven't seen them anyway in the examples I've looked at because they've been smaller kind of pilot programs.
Charlie Chipio is a research fellow at the Ash Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Charlie, thank you for the time.
Well, thank you, Steve. My pleasure.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the defeat of Eric Cantor in last night's congressional primary and what that could mean for immigration reform. And are we soon reaching a day when student athletes will be financially compensated? All of that still to come on Here and Now.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, working continuously to improve the grid so when you turn on your AC or charge your phone, you've got reliable, instant power. More about how SRP is delivering tomorrow's grid today at srpgrid.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 FM and online at kjzz.org. Valley forecast calling for sunny skies and a high near 105 degrees. 107 is expected for the high tomorrow. At 12 o'clock, it's NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Today, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel defended the swap of five Taliban detainees for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl in front of a House Armed Services Committee. In Valley traffic, there's a crash in the median on the State Route 51 southbound at Bell Road, another one on the Santan portion of the Loop 202 freeway westbound at Cooper Road, and on the I-10 westbound, there's a crash blocking the shoulder at 40th Street. It's 97 degrees in Phoenix at 11:44.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Last night's primary loss by U.S. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor has some observers saying that any opportunity to pass immigration reform in the current Congress is gone. That's even though Cantor's public expressions seem to indicate he wasn't exactly a supporter of reform, and that didn't keep his opponent from saying Cantor was pro-amnesty. So where does this leave immigration reform in Washington? Tamar Jacoby, president of Immigration Works USA, joins me for a few minutes. Hi, Tamar.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. So it seems confusing. So where did Eric Cantor stand on immigration reform?
Well, it is confusing, okay. So, but Eric Cantor was supportive of parts of immigration reform. We know that he was writing a House version of the DREAM Act, but he was careful and skeptical about some other pieces and didn't think that the House should go too fast. So, you know, I think he was in a place where I don't need to psychoanalyze him. I think he was the people who he was the supporter, but he wasn't a starry-eyed supporter or an unequivocal supporter. But, you know, I think his loss had to do with a lot of things. It wasn't just immigration. It's a blow to immigration. There's no kidding. There's no question that, you know, this is going to certainly change the calendar on how we do immigration. But I think the loss had to do with a lot of different things. And, you know, I'm just coming off the Hill. Obviously, everyone's talking about it today. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, everyone is kind of understanding that immigration played into it, but it also had to do with the fact that there's a conflict between being in leadership and representing your district, because he's been, I think in the past couple of years, he's been in, you know, 200 different districts raising money for other candidates when he could have been at home at the town hall in his district. Right. And, you know, the fact that he wasn't at home in the town hall in his district started to get noticed. I think there are many, and, you know, there's obviously Americans are unhappy with Congress, gridlock, it hasn't done things. Leadership is a lightning rod for that. There are a lot of things that played into this that weren't just immigration. There's still no question it's going to slow us down on immigration, but let's not exaggerate the role that immigration plays in it.
And what do you think about how this could or could not change House Speaker John Boehner's approach?
Well, look, again, I think there's no question that this changes the calendar. You know, the Republican Party has all, and House Republicans in particular, have always faced this difficult navigation between the national imperative to get it done and the national imperative to be part of the solution for political reasons and also because it's a problem that has to get solved, and the local imperative of the primary voters who are dead set against. That's always been a tricky navigation, and the House Republicans have been, you know, moving toward being supportive and more becoming supportive, and Boehner's been trying to get it done, and they've been doing that navigation. Again, this just shows us how hard it is, but it's another moment where you don't want to exaggerate how much it played into the defeat, because, you know, we're doing that calculation. How do we go between this rock and the hard place? If you exaggerate how big the rock is, you're going to have a hard time getting through. So, you know, it's very important to understand here, I guess, how much of a role the immigration did and didn't play, and understand that still going forward, we still have that national imperative to get it done. We got to figure out how to navigate between the rock and the hard place.
Well, I mean, based on what you know, and you know a lot, what steps could be taken going forward? Does this make it more likely that incremental, what some people like to call piecemeal approach, goes forward? I guess I want to know if you're optimistic about some aspect getting done this year.
It's always dangerous to predict from the moment and the morning after, right? the most optimistic thing I'll say is that I believe that what Paul Ryan has been saying recently is right. It's not about if, it's about when. Does this change the when and set us back? You know, of course it does to some degree, let's be honest. We've just got to come out of the hole and figure out how to help people understand that yes, it played in here, but it wasn't really, there were a lot of other factors, you know, and let's not generalize from one race where, you know, maybe where mistakes were made. You know, let's be honest, that pollster was making some mistakes and some mistakes were made, and where a leader didn't have time to spend enough time in his district.
Tamar, a minute or so left. At the same time, Senator Lindsey Graham, people have said this after last night, he had a would expect to be a tough primary race that turned out to not be tough at all, and he's been way out front as part of the Gang of Eight in the Senate. So, as you said, it's tough to put immigration reform on this, but does that indicate that people look at senators different, or are we just saying South Carolina, Virginia, who knows?
Well, I think it's a you know, there are many factors, right? No two races are alike, and certainly these two are nothing alike. So, in 30 seconds, I can't tell you the difference between okay. the South Carolina Senate and Virginia 8th. But your general point is right. Elections are local, and you know, again, let's not be. I'm not in denial. Immigration played some role in this, but let's sort out how much of a role, so that we don't exaggerate how much weight to put on that. And the party still has to do the hard work of figuring out how to navigate between those two things, the primary voters who are skeptical and the national imperative to get it done. That hasn't changed.
Tamar Jacoby is president of Immigration Works USA. Tamar, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me on.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A huge settlement earlier this week related to compensating college athletes had an Arizona tie. Former ASU quarterback Sam Keller had filed suit against the NCAA over the use of athletes' likenesses in video games produced by Electronic Arts or EA Sports. The settlement total is $20 million. Another case that's moving to the trial phase could lead to the NCAA lifting rules prohibiting college athletes from being paid for the use of their names or images in broadcasts and video games. Sports law attorney Timothy Liam Epstein of the Chicago firm Smith Amundsen joins me. Tim, how likely is it we'll see consistency and a process that might be sustainable for a couple of decades once these suits are either settled or decided in some way?
I don't know that we are really going to have something that's going to be radically different from what we have now. If you think that any of these lawsuits have any legs, because the legislation that has to come in to back up what would be the rewards that come out of these lawsuits is going to be significant. For example, Title IX. If you're going to start paying men's basketball and football players, what do you do about the women's volleyball team? And I think once you have these lawsuits cleared away, there needs to be some serious structural changes, not only coming from the NCAA and its membership, but from Congress.
Does the NCAA exist in some form after all these things are settled?
I think it can, and I think there's a desire to have it go on. Now, whether the NCAA is going to maintain its governance over what we would have been described as the BCS schools, I don't know that that necessarily will be the case, but there are a lot of other institutions that are out there that have sports programs that are not out there to make money. They're out there to enhance the student athlete and the student experience. And, you know, we call that Division II and Division III, and some schools in Division I would fall in that model as well. So there still is a need for organization and governing bodies over these member institutions, and certainly the NCAA could fill that role, obviously with a lot less resources if they don't have the money to hire people to do that.
And there has been dramatic talk of whether the so-called Big Five conferences would sort of take off and do their own thing to some extent. Just from the legal standpoint, what stands out to you about that? And is there a feeling that when people talk about being disgusted by this idea that some people are called student athletes when they're really not student athletes, would it be a good thing to have a brighter dividing line in the sense that we know sort of folks that are there to maybe get an education in some sense, and others who really are there to get the education, and sports are a part of that or maybe just a supplement to that?
Well, just to take your second question first, with regard to a division between a student athlete and really one that's more of an athlete that has a student in very small letters on the side, I think for your listeners, it's good for them to understand that it's not always the choice of the student athlete with regard to whether they're going to emphasize more on the student end of things or on the athlete end of things. And a lot of times the athletes themselves are demonized for just showing up at school for a little bit and taking off, and it's basically training ground for them to move on to a professional league or attempt to move on to a professional league. But if you look at the way things are scheduled, whether that be the fault of the school, the conference, the NCAA, or the networks that display the athletic contests, there are many, many, many days of school missed. There are limited options for when these student athletes can take classes, because you can't take class that may be offered on a certain day of the week or on a certain night, because you're going to have practice or you're going to have game or you're going to have a travel day. So it's not necessarily a bright line rule that the student athlete has any choice in. Now, whether the unionization efforts that began at Northwestern have any legs, I think that may give the student athletes, if it did actually get it to that point, some level of a voice over working conditions, which would include those things that may make the student athlete experience different from the average student experience in a general population.
Earlier this week, University of Kentucky gave its basketball coach, John Calipari, reportedly 7-year, $52 million contract. And I think if that were an NBA salary, people would just say, ridiculous, but fine, professional sports franchise. When it comes down to seeing a number like that, or what Nick Saban makes at Alabama as the football coach, and when we look at the actual legal aspect of it, when cases are brought and judges are deciding, do those things ever come into play, this idea of whether student-athletes should be able to unionize or student-athletes should be paid? Do they ever look at those things? Does that ever factor in, or do we have to separate that from the actual legal questions?
Yeah, I think it would be difficult from a legal perspective to look at what Coach Cal gets paid or look at what Nick Saban gets paid as some type of injustice that needs to be remedied relative to how we are, quote-unquote, compensating student-athletes that may be producing the revenue. It's difficult to insert that into a legal argument. What you could potentially say, if you're calculating damages and there's an argument from the institutions that they won't be able to give any money to these student athletes because they don't make money as an athletic department, or they make very little as an athletic department, certainly if you look at the accounting, one of the costs that go into determining what your gross revenues versus what your net proceeds are going to be is what you're paying people, and the coaches are going to be part of it. So, yeah, you can make money. It just depends on, are you going to cut back on coaches' salaries? Are you going to cut back on facilities? Are you going to cut back on actually some of the things that may benefit these student athletes, such as facilities or staying at the nicest possible hotels? So the money's there. It's just a matter of how you allocate it.
Tim, finally, what ruling or what decision would really make you take notice?
What I think people may not understand is that you're seeing settlements in terms of dollar amounts coming out of the O'Banion and the Keller cases. What's going to happen with O'Banion is not about money. O'Banion is looking to give the student athlete a seat at the bargaining table for them to be able to license out their own images, their own intellectual property. So it's going to be a ruling that would come from that judge in Oakland that would say you have to give the athletes a seat at the bargaining table. So the NCAA is not going to be able to write a check, either in settlement, or they could in settlement if O'Banion agreed to it, but in judgment, there's not going to be a check that's going to make this go away. It's going to be a change in the system. So I think we just wait to see what that ruling would be to see if they want to give the athletes a right to negotiate their images, and then what that applies to. Does it apply to jerseys? Does it apply to really broadcast rights is what we're talking about here now that the Keller case is settled with regard to video games. So that, I think, is the thing that people need to look out for. But just generally looking at the tea leaves for your listeners to see what, you know, the big issues are going to be. There are a couple cases that are out there, Alston and Jenkins, and that's about the difference really between the cost of attendance and what a full scholarship means, as well as the claim that scholarships fix the price in a competitive market for a student athlete. But concussions on the NCAA level, there are currently some lawsuits that are pending in the Northern District of Illinois, with a lead case being Arrington, that I think your listeners should look out for, because football drives college sports and the money that's in it. And if concussions are going to wear away at that money, then you're going to eat away at the power of the NCAA.
Sports law attorney Timothy Liam Epstein of the Chicago firm Smith Amundsen. That's all for this edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help, and thank you for listening. If you missed part of the program or want to hear one of our previous shows, you can go online to KJZZ.org later this afternoon. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. Now it's time for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great rest of the day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, with the highest-ranked MBA in Arizona, according to U.S. News & World Report. It's not too late to start an MBA this August. You can learn more and apply at asumba.com.